The church I inherited as a child talked constantly about how much Christian faith and worship had been corrupted since the first century, and how we had restored the true church one reads about in the New Testament. Our preachers made us feel special when they told us that our church was patterned exactly like those in which the apostles Paul and Peter worshiped. That was heady stuff when I was a teenager, but I grew up to discover how woefully wrong it was. If there is one certain truth about the early Christian church, it's that there was no formal pattern. Instead, there were so many different customs and creeds that if a time machine had set my boyhood church down among some of those early churches, we would have scratched our heads in total amazement. Instead of unity, there were so many quarrels about how to worship and which leaders to honor, about church government and which Christian writings were okay and which were not, that for several hundred years, the most urgent task of the new religion called Christianity was simply holding people together as they had once been held by the magic of Greece or the power of Rome. That it managed to do this through one grave crisis after another is one of the miracles of history, and it happened through a long, slow process of evolution during which devout believers battled over how to define Jesus and his relationship to God, the status of his mother, the power of bishops, and a dizzying array of other questions. Since Gary gave us some insight recently into the thought of later church theologians, I hope it might interest you to hear how things were in the very beginning, when an infant church was struggling to grow up. For example, the Apostle Paul could hardly have imagined the role of women in a church like this. Women were permitted to attend the worship service, but they had to come veiled because their hair was considered so seductive that not just poor, vulnerable men, but even hovering angels might be distracted. The famous scholar we call Saint Jerome thought female locks should be cut off entirely. The Apostle Paul had his own approach to the hair problem. He made the fascinating argument that men could go bareheaded in church since they are the image of God, while women are but a reflection of man's glory. After all, he says, man was not created for woman, but woman for man. And this is why she should cover her head, to symbolize subjection. If this all sounds... I know one guy who must have a rough time of it. If this all sounds remarkably silly, it's a reminder that customs change, and even the most daring minds are shaped by the times in which they live. When my church talked about restoring the early church, it conveniently overlooked the first century agape, or love feast, which was a kind of replication of the Last Supper Jesus shared with his disciples. At some point in this feast, the basic elements of a common meal, bread and wine, would be blessed, and the memory of Jesus honored in what would eventually evolve into the mysteries of Catholic Mass and Protestant Communion. But these meetings were quite unlike our celebrations of the Lord's Supper, and although they were closer to our fellowship dinners, there were some real differences. In the church at Corinth, for example, we learn that some people came early and ate so greedily that they left nothing for others and drank so much wine that the evening turned raucous, all of which led the Apostle Paul to say, "You ought to be ashamed. Behave yourselves." Another feature of early church life we agree to ignore. And still another custom of that early church fell victim by and by to the old bugaboo of sex. The custom must have had considerable importance because it was actually recommended 5 different times, Paul calling it the holy kiss and Peter calling it the kiss of love. We're told that in some congregations it was given only by men to men, and I've tried all week to keep from conjuring up images of Arafat kissing Saddam Hussein, or by women to other women, but that this restriction was not enforced in all churches. And in those churches, as you might guess, some of the participants discovered an untheological delight in this pleasant ceremony. So much so that the famous church father Clement of Alexandria said that the lips should not be opened in kissing, and that if it gave pleasure, the kiss should not be repeated. The love feast itself gradually disappeared during the 3rd century, and the holy kiss that sometimes became unholy gave way in the Western world to shaking hands. Personal behavior was a problem from the very first. The church struggled with sexual orientation. There was a notorious case of incest in one of them, and a husband-wife team conspired to defraud the congregation in still another. Church leaders were often at odds. The Apostle Paul and the Apostle Peter quarreled rather bitterly, it seems, over doctrinal issues, and a council had to be called to resolve the fuss. Paul himself proved that great men can have weak and ugly moments. The early church was made up mostly of Jews who had converted, and some of them argued that no Gentile male should be allowed to join the church without accepting the Jewish custom of circumcision. This upset Paul so much that he called those fellow Christians dogs and said that since they were so interested in cutting, he wished they would just go all the way and castrate themselves. Not a perfect pattern yet. If you had attended one of those early first century churches, you could have heard someone claim a gift called speaking in tongues and deliver what would sound to you like pure emotional gibberish. It must have been highly popular because Paul uses all his diplomatic skills in dealing with it. He never flatly orders that it be stopped, but he cleverly says things that he knows will diminish its appeal. When he says, "Always be sure to have someone interpret what you've said," he had to know it would occur to people to wonder why they shouldn't just speak intelligibly to begin with. A point he reinforces by saying that he too could do the ecstatic speech thing, but that he'd rather speak 5 words people could understand than 10,000 garbled sounds in the grip of emotional ecstasy. After all, he says, if strangers come to church and you're using this ecstatic speech, they're likely to think you have all gone mad. So gently but firmly, he begs them to grow up, reminding them that God is a God of order rather than chaos. Now, I said that my childhood church claimed to be just like the ones described in Scripture, but the truth is we were very careful about what we restored and what we ignored. And the holy kiss and speaking in tongues were just two of several things we preferred to forget about. But as you know, many churches called charismatic still practice speaking in tongues. So I was encouraged once, years ago, to invite a former student of mine who claimed that gift to share it with a politely skeptical audience at one of our Wednesday night study groups. She modestly said that she did not wish to speak to us directly, as if she were performing, but that she would use her gift in a prayer. And although she was quite calm, and the sounds she made in that prayer were melodious, none of us understood a single word of it. Part of my purpose for inviting her was to show that we had certainly not restored the church of the first century, and she helped make that point. Of even greater concern in that early church were the conflicting opinions for hundreds of years about the exact nature of Jesus. If you think there are widely different views on that subject now between, say, a Southern Baptist deacon and a Unitarian minister, you should acquaint yourself with the battles that raged in the early church as it tried to work out a uniform theology. If hearing about them serves no other purpose, it can keep us from thinking even for a moment that the Christian religion was set in stone from day one, and it can make us more tolerant of those who believe and worship differently from ourselves. Let's sample a few of the quarrels that kept the church in turmoil for several hundred years. One was called Gnosticism, a very serious rival to Orthodox faith. The name comes from the Greek word gnosis, or knowledge, which can tempt us to think that it primarily exalted intellect. But most followers of the movement understood gnosis to mean not knowledge in our modern sense of the word, but revelation. Gnostic Christians were more than just a little bit smug. Claiming to possess spiritual secrets through divine revelations that were not available to ordinary believers. They were mystics who had welcomed so many half-baked Greek and Asiatic philosophies that it would strain your patience to hear the details, but they were a great threat to stability in the early church. Any good book on the history of Christianity shows how great the odds were against the early church's struggle to survive. Consider a couple more splinter groups. A man named Marcion led one of them and stirred things up quite a bit when he decided that since only Paul had fully understood the gospel, no one else, just Paul, the church's scripture should contain only 10 of his letters plus the Gospel of Luke. And since Marcion found the Old Testament God unspeakably violent, he left out any scripture which implied that Jesus regarded this God as his father or as in any way related to him. The young Christian movement pronounced Marcion a heretic, but his followers kept unsettling it for quite a while. Those first few centuries of church life were often truly chaotic, troubled by one splinter group after another. Some were vegetarians, despised sex, held marriage to be a sin. Others argued that Christ's body was merely a phantom, and not human flesh at all, that he really was an exotic alien from another world. There were the Theodosians who argued Christ was indeed a man, and only a man, while the adoptionists responded, okay, he was born a man, but he became a God because of his perfect life. I hope you can forgive me for thinking that some of these people needed to find a job. So that early church, which my parents taught was so well organized, was actually a Mrs. Murphy's chowder of conflicting opinions. Some of them were simply too far ahead of their times. I like a guy named Pelagius, who stirred up a hornet's nest with his attack on the doctrine of original sin. Adam's fall in the garden, he said, involved only Adam, not the rest of us, and it's nonsense to believe that newborn babies inherit the sins of Adam. Well, I'm with him, but in the Council of Carthage, the larger church won that battle, arguing that babies do inherit Adam's sinful nature and have to be baptized to make them innocent. Otherwise, if they die, they are lost. And just to illustrate how the church continues to evolve, the Methodist Church for years recommended infant baptism on grounds of original sin until 1910, when delegates met in Asheville, North Carolina, and decided babies were born innocent after all, and baptizing them is more about dedication and commitment than about cleansing them of inherited wickedness. One more church battle I can't help mentioning, partly because one of you brought it up in a recent phone call, and partly because it so clearly shows how the early church struggled to create a uniform faith. In the face of growing reverence for the Mother of Jesus, a high-ranking church official named Nestorius declared that Mary should not be called Theotokos, Mother of God, although it would be okay to call her Mother of Jesus. As one of his disciples put it, let no one call Mary the Mother of God, for Mary was a human being, and that God should be born of a human being is impossible. Well, the reigning Pope said, take it back. And a huge church council was convened at Ephesus to settle the quarrel. A church father from Egypt showed up with 50 supporting bishops who favored calling Mary Mother of God, while Nestorius came with 16 bishops who agreed with him. Since he understood the danger of defying popular beliefs, he also brought along a company of armed soldiers. Because, you see, in those primitive times, devout people were not above convincing one another with swords. Aware that the odds were against him, Nestorius refused to attend the council until some other travel-delayed bishops could show up to support him. But the council began in his absence, stripped him of his ecclesiastical authority, and exiled him to a quiet and tranquil life out in the Libyan desert. So it is that Mary is still called Mother of God. Well, the whole point is that orthodoxy was not born fully formed. Now, I know no better way to put it than to say it slowly gelled as church leaders, from the village priest all the way up through the hierarchy to the Pope, became strong enough to crush dissent, create an official creed, and guarantee the survival of the church as an institution. It wasn't always a pretty picture, but it isn't always a pretty picture even now. Catholic Christians silence priests like Boston's Father Curran and scholar Hans Kuhn from their teaching posts for deviating from orthodoxy, and Protestant fundamentalists right here in River City warned their followers not to put their souls at risk by entering an all-white church on 29th Street. They really do. As more than one wise soul has pointed out, many cliches become cliches because they express eternal truth, like the one I chose as the title for this morning's sermon. The potent wine of religious faith is as much in ferment today as it was 2,000 years ago. Some things never change.